This is episode 18 of Book Banter, and I'm your host, Alex C. Talander. This episode is brought to you by Angie's List. Next time you need someone to work on your home, repair your car, or fix your teeth, check Angie's List first. You'll find thousands of unbiased ratings on services for home improvements, car repairs, and even doctors. Let Angie's List take away the guesswork. Gain access to thousands of reviews on local service providers for home improvement, accounting, animal care, health care, and even weddings. Join Angie's List and use promo code BOOK to get 25% off your membership. And in this episode, I'll be talking with author Joe Schreiber about his two new books that have just come out. There is the Star Wars horror novel, Star Wars Death Troopers, and his other original horror novel, No Doors, No Windows. We'll begin first with my review for Star Wars Death Troopers, which will be followed by my interview with Joe Schreiber, followed by the review for his other book, No Doors, No Windows, and then a number of reviews, including Distant Early Warnings, an anthology of Canadian science fiction, edited by Robert J. Sawyer, The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins, and finally, my reviews for Brandon Sanderson's young adult novels, Alcatraz vs. the Evil Librarians, and Alcatraz vs. the Scrivener's Bones. But first, we begin with my review for Star Wars Death Troopers by Joe Schreiber. All good horror novels have a foundation using a familiar horror trope, whether it be zombies, vampires, deepest darkest space, or creepy children. The really great horror novels employ multiple tropes to become terrifying, page-turning nightmares that the reader simply can't put down. Star Wars Death Troopers is one of those horror novels. The Imperial prison ship Purge is on its way through deep space to a distant and forgotten moon to deposit its cargo of 500 of the galaxy's most ruthless prisoners, as well as two teenage brothers who are there on a non-existent charge. Everything is going as expected, or at least as expected as can be for Trigg and Kale Longo, trying their best to stay alive and wondering how their lives have come to this, until the Purge experiences engine trouble. Fortunately, there is a Star Destroyer nearby that is a derelict, abandoned. Two teams are sent onto the destroyer with a couple of engineers to raid it for engine parts. They return, coughing and getting sicker by the second. Zahara Cody, chief medical officer, scrambles to do what she can, but the sickness gets worse and people begin dying. The virus spreads throughout the barge and soon bodies are dropping everywhere. All that remain are the few people who are somehow immune, Trigg and Kale and Zahara to name a few. Zahara also discovers two familiar characters locked up deep within the bowels of the ship in solitary confinement. Then all the bodies come to life. And these zombies are smarter than any we've seen before. They adapt to each situation, always looking to kill and conquer, always in search of fresh meat. Joe Schreiber's Star Wars Death Troopers employs a number of great horror tropes that all combine to form one great novel that will have readers hooked from start to finish. He manages the plot well, with riveting cliffhanger chapters, and makes it impossible to put down, while slowly dishing out the details so that full understanding and realization is not reached until the last few pages. But these are all important facets of a great horror novel. And now we have my interview with Joe Schreiber. So where did the idea for Death Troopers come from?
It was an idea that my editor at Delray Books, Keith Clayton, had been talking to with a couple other people. He was really involved in the Star Wars Expanded Universe books, and they were at a convention one year tossing around the idea of a Star Wars horror novel. And he sort of just mentioned it to my agent. He mentioned it to me, and we kicked some ideas around and sort of came up with the outline for Death Troopers.
Okay, and so basically that's how you got involved with the Star Wars projects, is your agent contacted you?
Yeah, sort of through Keith. I mean, Keith had been, like I said, my editor for my other books, and he just had a good sort of editorial eye in general. But they were at Comic-Con one year or something, drinking at the bar, and they were like, wouldn't it be cool to, you know, do a Star Wars horror novel, and sort of just evolved from there.
Okay, and so did it feel very different writing in the Star Wars universe? Did you enjoy it more than writing your regular books?
Well, it was definitely a different experience in that it's such a well-mapped-out universe, but as far as feeling different, I think that I was writing in the same sort of way that I always write, which is just trying to write a very compelling story and write something that the reader is just going to want to keep reading and keep turning the pages, hopefully stay up all night to find out how it ends. So in that sense, it was very much in tune with my usual experience when I write. I'm just trying to go for that compulsive reading experience. But there's also definitely that sense of wanting to be true to the Star Wars universe, right, and the franchise that way as well.
And so what about when you were writing some of the, you know, the well-known characters? How did that feel?
Oh, it was terrific. I mean, it was such a great, fun experience to do that. You could, I mean, somebody like me who grew up with those movies, you hear those characters' voices in your head, and just being able to channel them was, and put them into the story that I was telling was just completely exciting.
So did you kind of do a lot of research and read up on the books to get the voices right in your head, or did it just come naturally?
Well, what I, you know, mainly the research that I did came from reference guides that the Lucasfilm people had sent me, and it was mainly details about technology, droids, planet ships, and that sort of thing. As far as the characters, I mean, really, the characters that from the established Star Wars characters that I used in my book, they just, I felt, you know, I sort of felt intuitively in tune with them, and in that sense, just sort of came from the gut.
Okay. And so each chapter pretty much in Death Troopers ends on kind of a cliffhanger. Is this something intentional that you worked at, or was it something you just did naturally?
Well, it's a natural thing, but it's definitely something that I'm aware of as I'm doing it. I mean, my feeling is my favorite reading experiences are the ones that just pull you along and create that forward momentum. And so I guess I just tend to naturally structure that way. And when I was writing it, that's sort of what I brought to the story.
And then that way the reader keeps turning the page, wanting to read more.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I actually had a book banter listener wanted me to ask you actually if the virus that you mentioned and talk about in Death Troopers, if it's related to the Rock Ghoul plague.
There's no real deliberate link between those now that I know of.
Okay, because I was talking to him about it and he immediately brought that up and it sounded kind of similar. That's all. So there's no link. Okay, I was just curious.
Yeah, I don't think so, unless it's this subconscious thing on my part.
And then you mentioned that, so the project name for the virus is Blackwing, but that's also a term you use in your other book, No Doors, No Windows. Is there any link with this, or is it just coincidence?
No, it's not coincidence. It's just sort of a playful sort of thing that it comes along with having the chance to do a couple of things sort of simultaneously. There's a character in No Doors, No Windows who's sitting in a bar reading a Death Troopers book too. So, just a couple of little throwaway type of things that I enjoyed putting in there. I think there's a couple of characters that show up in both books as well. just because I just couldn't resist. It was just too good of a too much fun not to do. So I put those guys in there.
So in Death Troopers and No Doors, No Windows, you've got a young boy as a character. Is this something you like to write as a character, something you can relate to?
Well, it's definitely something that I'm sort of in tune with in a natural narrative sense. I mean, some of the books that I was really dug growing up are some of Stephen King's books, like The Shining and The Talisman, where you've got young people in jeopardy and trying really hard to make courageous decisions in the face of really insurmountable, terrible situations. So that's sort of something I brought in kind of almost involuntarily without thinking about it. People give me a hard time about it because I'm a parent of kids myself, and they're just like, man, why are you constantly putting kids in these terrible situations? I really have no defense at all except for, you know, my next book, I'm going to try really hard to leave the kids out of it, give them a little bit of a break for a while.
Okay. Where did the title Death Troopers come from, and were there any other working titles you had?
There were a list of working titles that we had, and they were really all forgettable. I mean, honestly, there was a problem with genre fiction and horror fiction is we tend to generally kind of come up with a lot of kind of type of things. It's like, oh, it's so scary, this title, and most of them just seem silly or even worse. They just kind of lay there, and Death Troopers was really the standout from the beginning. And originally, they were talking about calling it Dead Troopers, and it seemed a little awkward, but Death Troopers was the one that sort of grabbed people, so that's what we went
dry.
With.
Yeah. And what about the artwork for the cover? Where'd that come from?
They went to the people that designed the posters for the Saw movies for that, which when they told me that, I was like, that's no brainer. I could totally made sense once they told me that. I was like, yeah, it's absolutely, definitely has that look to it. And we were just all blown away by it when they came back with it, equally by the art, but also by the fact that Lucasfilm was okay with it. We were like, really? They're all right with that? So we were pretty psyched when that's what they came up with.
Yeah, honestly, that's what actually caught my eye. When I first saw the cover, I knew I had to read it, even though I'd never read a Star Wars book before.
Yeah, I was psyched. I mean, they sent it to me, and at first I was like, are you kidding? But they were serious. I was like, wow, that's amazing. And not long after that, it showed up on... started showing up on websites and stuff like that. I think a lot of people really responded strongly to it. So I was just really fortunate that's what they chose to do with it, I think.
And then with the hardcover release coming out on the 13th, it's got the dust jacket actually folds out to like a mini poster, right?
Yeah, isn't that cool? I found out about that and I was like, wow, I've never seen that before. You know, I've seen people do crazy things with covers and stuff. You see, you know, shiny letters, and you know, they do raised lettering and stuff like that. But when I saw they were doing that, I was like, no, that's awesome, because it's the same kind of art that they were using, I think, for the big posters they were getting out of Comic-Con and stuff like that. So I think that people are really going to enjoy that.
Yeah, definitely. Do you plan on writing more maybe in the Star Wars universe?
Yep, I have another one coming out next year that is another Star Wars horror novel that'll be due out October 2010. So that's sort of in the editing stages now.
Mm-hmm. And it's not linked with Death Troopers in any way, is it?
Not specifically, no. It's not. They're not calling it a sequel.
Okay. So how did you get involved in writing? How did you start writing?
It's one of the things I just sort of always did, even before I was, publishing anything, even as a kid. It's just something that I knew I wanted to pursue, and I wrote short stories, and I wrote a novel, my first novel I wrote back in high school, and it was awful, and I still have it, and I pull it out once in a while and just cringe, but I've always done it just as what I've done, and I've always sort of known that regardless if I ever made a penny with it, it was this thing I was just going to always pursue.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a set writing schedule you keep to every day?
Not generally, no. I mean, I have a day job and I have a family, and really a lot of the time I spend writing is time I manage to sort of steal one way or another and sneak down to the basement and write. But the Star Wars books was a little different because the deadline was a little bit more pressing, and my wife fortunately is pretty forgiving about stuff like that. So they're able to make time for me to go and just disappear for a couple hours a day and work on it. I tend to be pretty disciplined when I have that opportunity to do that every day, but sometimes there's just no time.
Okay, and so you do to kind of write on anything you have at hand when you get a chance to write?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I have a laptop that I sort of carry around the house like this nomadic novelist looking for a quiet room to work in. Sometimes it works out better than others, but I've been known to take it into the bathroom and close the door if I absolutely have to find peace and quiet.
So you mentioned you were working on a new Star Wars horror novel. Are you working on anything else, too?
I have another novel coming out next year, which is an original horror novel based on the TV show Supernatural that I'm doing for DC Comics and Titan Books. And I think that'll be out next fall as well. And then another original novel that's sort of just sort of in the embryonic phases right now, but I'd really like to really launch that and get started on that and have it out probably the year after.
Okay. And do you have a favorite author or favorite authors you like to read a lot?
These days I read everybody. Some of my favorites are like Cormac McCarthy. I love his stuff. I always have. Books like Blood Meridian by him are amazing. But I also read a lot of crime fiction. There's a really cool crime writer named Dwayne Swierczynski who's wrote a book called Severance Package, and he also writes the comic book Cable every month, and I read everything he writes. Obviously the great Stephen King, Peter Straub, Clive Barker, I still read quite a bit. But I read, I read just about everybody. I think right now I've got the new James Ellroy book on my desk. And just a couple of things that I'm trying to get through. So I read all over the map.
And so what, when you get bits of spare time, when you're not writing, what do you like to do for fun?
Well, most of my time, my kids are 5 and 7. So a lot of the time I spend just with them. They're homeschooled. And so I actively participate in their schooling, and I work in a hospital and I travel when I get the chance, and I like to spend as much time outside as I can. But it's a busy little life right now. I've got a lot of things going on. So mainly my family, though. I mean, they'll take me however they can get me. So I tend to spend a lot of time with them.
Okay. All right. And then for my last couple of questions, which are the hardest ones, what's your favorite Star Wars movie?
Empire, no question.
That's the correct answer.
No hesitation on that one at all. It's funny because I just got done writing. I was doing another interview, and a guy was like, how did you become such a Star Wars fan? And I was like, yeah, I was 7 years old. My dad took me to see Star Wars. It was great. But it was really, I think it was Empire that really just won me over for life, I think. I remember every second of that experience. The first time around, I was like, wow, this is what 3X structure is like. This is what character development is like. Basically, it was just like an hour and a half, two-hour clinic in storytelling. And you didn't realize it when you're 10 years old, but that's why it hooked you so hard. That's a movie that does every single thing right.
So it was a pretty much a life-changing moment for you there, huh?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't even stop at religious. I think that definitely it was you get that feeling of awe from the beginning. It was from the very get-go. I mean, Star Wars, I was almost too young to remember the situation of it emerging, but I specifically remember counting down the days till Empire came to my theater near me, and it did not disappoint.
And then for my last question, if you could be any Star Wars character, who would you be?
That is, you did save the hardest one for last. Salacious Crumb. I want to sit on Jabba's shoulder and just laugh at everyone as they get sentenced to various imaginative dooms. I think if my lot in life was just to sit on the shoulder of some great greedy intergalactic crime lord and cackle at the fate of the doomed, I don't think I could ask for a better situation than that.
That way you never get in trouble and you get to watch all the fun and enjoy it.
Exactly. You get the table scraps and you get the nonstop entertainment.
All right. Well, thanks very much for doing the interview.
No problem, Alex. It was good talking to you.
Thanks.
And that was my interview with author Joe Schreiber. And now we move on to my review of Joe Schreiber's book, No Doors, No Windows. It's been recommended that writers should stick to writing what they know when it comes to writing. What better character can a writer write about than him or herself, a writer? But the writer in Joe Schreiber's new novel, No Doors, No Windows, is one with a dark, disturbing past that even he doesn't fully understand until the last few pages of the book, and has worked hard to forget and stay away from. One hopes that Joe Schreiber isn't anything like his character, Scott Mast. Scott Mast wanted to make it big as a writer, but it never happened. So now he spends his days living relatively well, writing copy for greeting cards. He currently lives in Seattle and is happily far away from his family and old life where he grew up. That is, until his father dies and he must return home to New Hampshire, finding an alcoholic loser of a brother with a son who he neglects and fails at being a decent father to. As Mast contemplates what he can do to help, there's the touchy history of their mother having died 15 years ago in a horrific fire. He discovers an unfinished manuscript his father was apparently working on. It's about a very special house where there are no corners or edges. Everything is curved and rounded. In this house, there is a door that leads to the Black Wing, where there are no doors and no windows, where terrible things happen. But the story is unfinished, and Mast decides that he must finish the book himself. After meeting up with an old girlfriend, their failed relationship is its own doomed story, he stumbles upon a remote house that turns out to be exactly like the one in his father's manuscript. And so Mast rents the house and begins writing the story, feeling a strange presence overtake him when he is adding to the manuscript. He knows it has something to do with the house, but he doesn't know what. Meanwhile, his brother falls deeper into his booze-filled spiral, leaving young Henry alone and abandoned. The clues gently fall into place with each chapter, as Shriver leads the reader wanting more, forcing the turning of the page and the need to know what is the story behind Scott Mast and his strange mental state. What's the story behind the house? What's the deal with Mast's brother? And most importantly, what's the story behind the Mast family that deals with the dark history of the town? Horror readers will enjoy No Doors, No Windows for its psychological thrill ride that doesn't get revealed and resolved until the very last pages of the book. And now, my review for Distant Early Warnings, Canada's Best Science Fiction, edited by Robert J. Sawyer. Readers who either don't read a lot of science fiction or who don't read a wide breadth of science fiction may look at Distant Early Warnings and wonder, Canada has science fiction writers? Then they'll read down the list of the stories included in this collection by authors like Julie E. Cherneda, Nalo Hopkinson, and Robert Charles Wilson, and think to themselves, they're Canadian? And finally they'll look and see that Distant Early Warnings is edited by Robert J. Sawyer, a brilliant science fiction writer who has won just about every award possible, and think, he's Canadian too? Not only is science fiction alive and well and being skillfully created and written in the great country north of the United States, but it is in fact home to some of the best science fiction writers alive today. In Sawyer's wonderfully short and precise introduction, he knows to not bore the reader with a lengthy passage talking about what he thinks about Canadian science fiction, but lets the stories speak for themselves. He explains that the title comes from a string of radar stations in Canada's far north designed to detect incoming Soviet bombers during the Cold War. The collection kicks off with the best story, In Spirit, where it is the near future, and a new form of technology exists, where it is possible to travel back in time as a holographic image to view events of the past. While still in its testing stages, a prisoner is chosen, giving him the opportunity of freedom if he goes through all the stages of traveling into the past. What is eventually discovered is that this man was involved in the September 11th attacks, and he is being punished by traveling back to the catastrophic day and being made to experience action and reaction through the eyes of those who suffered. Then there are those strange people who seem to somehow recognize him during his travels, which should be impossible. The collection features stories that work on many different levels, like The Ray Gun, A Love Story, by James Allen Gardner, as the reader wonders how far the character will go to protect his very special artifact. Then there is Robert Charles Wilson's haunting and disturbing tale, The Cartesian Theater, which explores the idea of cloning and what is the true meaning of life, living, and the idea of a soul. Sawyer kicks it up a notch with his lightning round at the end of the book, featuring stories by himself and others in the collection that are only a couple of pages long. And when you're done with this collection, Sawyer makes sure to point out if the authors have won awards and what are the works they've published, to give readers ideas on what to read next. If anything, distant early warnings will open the mind of any reader to some of the great work in literature being produced by some of today's Canadian authors. And now, The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. From the author of the best-selling Underland Chronicles comes the first in a brilliant new series that will change how you view your everyday life in more ways than you can count. Collins has taken a science fiction archetype, a doomed future world where everyone gets by, barely, with a certain cast of characters that sets off the reader's emotions to unknown bounds. North America, the future. Now known as Panem, it is a changed world, the country divided into districts, each district with its own industrial focus, mining, farming, manufacturing. For the most part, many in the district struggle to get by, struggle to survive. Our main character, Katniss Everdeen, is a 16-year-old girl who has spent her life helping her family, her mother and younger sister, hunting for food and scraps, fighting to keep them all alive. She's a teen beyond her years. The annual event of the Hunger Games arrives, a stark reminder of how worse things could really be if the capital didn't control the districts. A boy and a girl, between 12 and 18, are selected from each district and forced to participate in the games. Katniss's younger sister gets picked, and Katniss does what she's always done, steps in front, volunteering in her sister's place, saving her life. Then she is off to the Hunger Games. In the style of The Running Man, it is a nationally televised event, akin to the gladiatorial games of Rome, with much pomp and circumstance. 24 kids find themselves put into the ring, an unknown terrain that may or may not be habitable. And with the sound of a gong and the start of the games, they must fight each other to the death until one last child remains standing. The children find themselves under constant pressure to survive in the environs, to defend themselves against each other, and if the viewers get bored, creatures may be released to keep them on their toes. The Hunger Games is one of those books that could be shelved in the young adult section for its use of teen characters, or the science fiction section for its powerful storytelling of a future world with some undeniable and harsh similarities to our own, or the fiction section for its strong characters who deal with very human emotions while fighting each other to survive. This is strongest in Katniss, who knows how to hunt and fight for herself, but knows little of love and caring for those other than her family. And yet in the Hunger Games, sometimes you must make allies to survive, at a cost, for eventually you will have to kill your ally. The Hunger Games will have you on the edge of your seat, flipping the pages, but also wanting to read slowly and savor the incredible story. And at the end, you'll be somewhat annoyed by the abrupt finish. Have no fear, the sequel Catching Fire is now available, while Collins continues to work on the third book in the series. And now, my review for Brandon Sanderson's Alcatraz vs. the Evil Librarians. I write this under the pen name of book reviewer Alex E. Talander, so I can keep the librarians happy and unsuspecting. If you're reading this, then you must have heard about the supposed fictional book, Alcatraz vs. the Evil Librarians. Good for you. You have taken the first step to learning the truth. This book isn't really by Brandon Sanderson. It's a cover for the true story and biography of Alcatraz Smedri. In his first book in the series, you'll learn about Alcatraz and why he's always breaking everything he touches. It's because that's his special power. In fact, he thought he was an orphan. Yeah, like Harry Potter. Only turns out he was just being protected. On his 13th birthday, after burning the kitchen down because he broke the stove, he gets a bag of sand as a gift from the parents he never knew he had, an inheritance, and it gets stolen. His grandfather appears from nowhere and just rescues him in time. His special ability is that he arrives late for everything. Really handy when you're being shot at. Alcatraz soon finds out that the world isn't what he thinks it is, that there's other places he never knew existed. But it's all because of those evil librarians. They're behind everything. They've pulled the wool over our eyes for a long time. But if you're reading this, then maybe you'll read Alcatraz's story and find out what the truth is. The evil librarians control everything. But it's up to Alcatraz, along with the help from his family and an appointed bodyguard, a girl who's a knight of the Crystallia, to try and stop these librarians and get that important bag of sand back. because the sand can be used to make lenses, which have special powers, and this sand will make a lens that can read any language, even the ancient language, which nobody knows how to read. So now you've read this fake book review about a fictional book called Alcatraz versus the Evil Librarians by Brandon Sanderson. Go out and get the book at any bookstore. Avoid the library, because that's where the evil librarians are, and find out what the real world is like. Think The Matrix, only better. And for my final review, we have Alcatraz versus the Scrivener's Bones by Brandon Sanderson. Welcome back to another fake review of the supposed fictional book in the Brandon Sanderson series, Alcatraz versus the Scrivener's Bones. I'm just pretending to be the book reviewer, but I know the truth about the real world, and I'm going to tell you a little more about it. Don't let the librarians or teachers see this. Brandon Sanderson is really a pen name for Alcatraz Smedri, who's out to stop the evil librarians who are controlling the world. In this next book of his biography, Alcatraz tells a story of how he has to travel to the Great Library of Alexandria in Egypt. Yep, it's still there, with every book and piece of writing ever recorded. No, it wasn't destroyed. See how you don't know the real truth? He's going there to find out about his father, who he's never even met. He's traveling in this really cool giant glass dragon, along with his family, his cousin Singh, whose talent is always tripping at the wrong moment, his cousin Quentin, whose talent is to speak gibberish, and his cousin Australia, whose special ability is she wakes up looking ugly or looking like whoever she was dreaming of. As you might have guessed, the Smedri family are all named after prisons. But if Alcatraz wants to find his father, he'll have to get past the terrifying library curators, who will suck out your soul if you pick up any of the books in the Library of Alexandria. And then there's the Scrivener's Bones, who are on his tail. Will he survive this time? I'm not going to tell you, it's too dangerous. Just go out and get the book and find out for yourself. And that about wraps up this episode of Book Banter. Thank you very much for joining me. And I'll hopefully see you next time on November 1st, where I will hopefully be interviewing author Seth Graham Smith, who is the author of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. We'll be talking all about how he came up with that book and what he has planned for his future books. For now, head on over to bookbanter.net and check out some of the book reviews up there. There's also the Book Banter blog that I try to keep updated every day. Otherwise, thank you again for joining me, and I'll see you next time.